Side 9, Man and His Symbols, by Carl G. Jung. Continuing with Symbolism in the Visual Arts, on page 271. Photo captions. Variation within a Sphere, number 10. The Sun, by Richard Lippold. Above left, the stone alignments at Karnak in Brittany, dating from about 2000 B.C. Crude stones set upright in rows that are thought to have been used in sacred rituals and religious processions. Left, rough stones resting on raked sand in a Zen Buddhist rock garden in the Ryo-Anji Temple, Japan. Though apparently haphazard, the stone's arrangement in fact expresses a highly refined spirituality. Right, a prehistoric menhir, a rock that has been slightly carved into a female form, probably a mother goddess. Far right, a sculpture by Max Ernst, born 1891, has also hardly altered the natural shape of the stone. Far left, animal paintings on cave walls at Lascaux. The paintings were not simply decorative, they had a magical function. Left, a drawing of a bison covered with arrow and spear marks. The cave dwellers believed that by ritually killing the image, they would be more likely to kill the animal. Even today, the destruction of an effigy or statue is a symbolic killing of the person depicted. Right, a statue of Stalin destroyed by Hungarian rebels in 1956. Far right, rebels hang a bust of the former Stalinist Hungarian premier Matyas Rákosi. Far left, a prehistoric painting from Trois Frères Cave includes, lower right corner, a human figure, perhaps a shaman, with horns and hoofs. As examples of animal dances, left, a Burmese buffalo dance in which masked dancers are possessed by the buffalo spirit, right, a Bolivian devil dance in which the dancers wear demonic animal masks, far right, an old Southwest German folk dance in which the dancers are disguised as witches and as animal-like wild men. Left, a mask used in the ancient No drama of Japan, in which the players often portray gods, spirits, or demons. Above right, masked performers in Japanese dance theater. Below right, an actor in Japan's kabuki drama dressed as a medieval hero with mask-like makeup. Examples of animal symbols of divinities from three religions. Top of page, the Hindu god Ganesha, a painted sculpture from the Royal Palace of Nepal, god of prudence and wisdom. Above, the Greek god Zeus in the form of a swan with Leda. Right, on opposite sides of a medieval coin, the crucified Christ shown as a man and as a serpent. Right, a yantra, a form of mandala, composed of 9 linked triangles. The mandala, symbolizing wholeness, is often connected with exceptional beings of myth or legend. Far right, a Tibetan painting of the birth of Buddha. In the lower left corner, Buddha takes his first steps on a cross formed of circular blossoms. Above right, the birth of Alexander the Great, a 16th century manuscript illustration, heralded by comets in circular or mandala form. Left, an example of the mandala in religious architecture, the Angkor Wat Buddhist Temple in Cambodia, a square building with entrances at the four corners. Right, the ruins of a fortified camp in Denmark, about AD 1000, which was laid out in a circle, as is the fortress town, center right, of Palmanova, Italy, built in 1593, with its star-shaped fortifications. Far right, the streets that meet at L'Étoile, Paris, to form a mandala. Medieval religious architecture was usually based on the shape of the cross. Left, a 13th century church in Ethiopia cut from the rock. Renaissance religious art shows a reorientation to the earth and the body. Right, a plan for a circular church or basilica based on the body's proportions, drawn by the 15th century Italian artist and architect Francesco di Giorgio. The Renaissance interest in outer reality produced the Copernican sun-centered universe, left, and turned artists away from imaginative art to nature. Below left, Leonardo's study of the human heart. Renaissance art, with its sensuous concern with light, nature, and the body, far left, a Tintoretto, 16th century, set a pattern that lasted until the Impressionists. Below, a painting by Renoir, 1841 to 1919. Far left, the symbolic alchemical concept of the squared circle, symbol of wholeness and of the union of opposites. Note the male and female figures. Left, a modern squared circle by the British artist Ben Nicholson, born 1894. It is a strictly geometrical, empty form possessing aesthetic harmony and beauty, but without symbolic meaning. Right, a sun wheel, in a painting by the modern Japanese artist Sofu Teshigahara, born 1900, follows the tendency of many modern painters, when using circular shapes, to make them asymmetrical. Left, Limits of Understanding, by Paul Klee, 1879 to 1940, one 20th century painting in which the symbol of the circle retains a dominant position. Circles appear broken or loosely scattered in The Sun and the Moon, top, by Robert Delaunay, 1885 to 1941, in A Few Circles, left, by Kandinsky, 1866 to 1944, and in Landscape from a Dream, right, by Paul Nash, 1889 to 1946. Below, Composition by Piet Mondrian, 1872 to 1944, is dominated by squares. Above, an illustration from a 16th century German broadsheet of some strange circular objects seen in the sky, similar to the flying saucers that have been seen in recent years. Jung has suggested that such visions are projections of the archetype of wholeness. Sensory or representational art versus imaginative or unrealistic art. Right, a painting by the 19th century British artist William Frith, part of a sequence depicting a gambler's downfall. This is one extreme of representational art. It has declined into mannerism and sentiment. Left, an extreme of imaginative and here abstract art by Kazimir Malevich, 1878 to 1935. Suprematist Composition, White on White, 1918. Collection, The Museum of Modern Art, New York. Left and above, two compositions by Kurt Schwitters, 1887 to 1948. His kind of imaginative art uses and transforms ordinary things, in this case, old tickets, paper, metal, etc. Below left, pieces of wood similarly used by Hans Arp, 1887 to 1966. Below, in a sculpture by Picasso, 1881 to 1973, ordinary objects, leaves, are part of the subject rather than the material. An example of surrealist art, Les Souliers Rouges, by the French painter René Magritte, 1898 to 1967. Much of the disturbing effect of surrealist painting comes from its association and juxtaposition of unrelated objects, often absurd, irrational, and dreamlike. Both Giorgio de Chirico, born 1888, and Marc Chagall, born 1887, have sought to look behind the outward appearances of things. Their work seems to have risen from the depths of the unconscious, but Chirico's vision, below his philosopher and poet, was gloomy, melancholy, even nightmarish. Chagall's has always been rich, warm, and alive. Right, one of his great stained glass windows, created in 1962 for a Jerusalem synagogue. In Chirico's Song of Love, left, the marble head of the goddess and the rubber glove are crass opposites. The green ball seems to act as a uniting symbol. Right, Metaphysical Muse by Carlo Carrà, 1881 to 1966. The faceless mannequin was a frequent theme of Chirico's as well. One of the best known of modern surrealist painters is Salvador Dali, born 1904. Above, his famous painting, The Burning Giraffe. Below, one of Max Ernst's frottage, usually rubbings taken from scratches on tiles, from his Natural History. Ernst's Natural History resembles the interest taken in the past in accidental patterns in nature. Below, an engraving of an 18th-century Dutch museum exhibit that is also a kind of surrealist natural history, with its inclusion of coral, stones, and skeletons. Right. Roman coins used in places progressively farther away from Rome. On the last coin, farthest from the controlling center, the face has disintegrated. This strangely corresponds to the psychic disintegration that such drugs as LSD-25 can induce. Below, drawings done by an artist who took this drug in a test held in Germany in 1951. The drawings grow more abstract as conscious control is overcome by the unconscious. The paintings on these pages, all by Franz Marc, 1880 to 1916, show his gradual development away from a concern with outward things toward a more completely abstract art. Far left, Blue Horses, 1911. Center, Rose in a Wood, 1913-1914. Below, Play of Forms, 1914. Left, Piet Mondrian's painting number 1, an example of the modern approach to pure form, Mondrian's term, through the use of wholly abstract geometrical shapes. Painting number 1, 1926. Collection, the Museum of Modern Art, New York. The art of Powell Clay is a visual exploration and expression of the spirit in and behind nature, the unconscious, or as he termed it, the secretly perceived. Sometimes his vision can be disturbing and demonic, as in his Death and Fire, Wright, or it can be a more poetic kind of fantasy, as in his Sinbad the Sailor, far right. The paintings of Jackson Pollock, left, his number 23, were painted in a trance, unconsciously, as are the works of other modern artists, such as the French action painter Georges Mathieu, far left. The chaotic but powerful result may be compared to the massa confusa of alchemy, and strangely resembles the hitherto hidden forms of matter as revealed in microphotographs. See Part 1, Approaching the Unconscious. Right, a similar configuration. A vibration pattern made by sound waves in glycerin. Top left and center. Two sculptures by Marino Marini, 1901 to 1966, from 1945 and 1951, respectively, show how the theme of horse and rider was altered from an expression of tranquility to one of tortured fear and despair, while the sculptures themselves grew correspondingly more and more abstract. Marini's later work was influenced by the equally panic-stricken shapes of bodies found at Pompeii. Left. In this century, the depiction of actuality, once the province of the painter and sculptor, has been taken over by the photographer, whose camera can not only record, but, like any landscape painting of past centuries, can express the photographer's own emotional experience of the subject. Right. A Japanese scene, photographed by Werner Bischoff, 1916 to 1954. Mid-20th century art seems to be moving away from a Marini-like despair, as is seen in the gesture of Jean Lursat, who exhibited his work in a field, top left, a link with nature and the earth. Above, Dédicace à Sainte Marie-Madeleine by Alfred Monassier, born 1911. Top right, Pour la naissance du surhomme, by Francis Pierre-Yves Trémois, born 1921. Both works indicate a tendency toward life and wholeness. The painting, right, by Pierre Soulages, born 1919, might be understood as a symbol of hope. Behind the cataclysmic darkness can be seen a glimmer of light. End of photo captions. Part 5. Symbols in an Individual Analysis by Yolanda Jacobi. The beginning of the analysis. There is a widespread belief that the methods of Jungian psychology are applicable only to middle-aged people. True, Many men and women reach middle age without achieving psychological maturity, and it is therefore necessary to help them through the neglected phases of their development. They have not completed the first part of the process of individuation that Dr. M. L. von Franz has described. But it is also true that a young person can encounter serious problems as he grows up. If a young person is afraid of life and finds it hard to adjust to reality, he might prefer to dwell in his fantasies or to remain a child. In such a young person, especially if he is introverted, one can sometimes discover unexpected treasures in the unconscious, and by bringing them into consciousness, strengthen his ego and give him the psychic energy he needs to grow into a mature person. That is the function of the powerful symbolism of our dreams. Other contributors to this book have described the nature of these symbols and the role they play in man's psychological nature. I wish to show how analysis can aid the individuation process by taking the example of a young engineer, aged 25, whom I shall call Henry. Henry came from a rural district in eastern Switzerland. His father, of Protestant peasant stock, was a general practitioner. Henry described him as a man with high moral standards, but a rather withdrawn person who found it difficult to relate to other people. He was more of a father to his patients than to his children. At home, Henry's mother was the dominant personality. "We were raised by the strong hand of our mother," he said on one occasion. She came from a family with an academic background and wide artistic interests. She herself, in spite of her strictness, had a broad spiritual horizon. She was impulsive and romantic. She had a great love for Italy. Though she was by birth a Catholic, her children had been brought up in the Protestantism of their father. Henry had a sister, older than himself, with whom he had a good relationship. Henry was introverted, shy, finely drawn, and very tall, with light hair, a high pale forehead, and blue eyes with dark shadows. He did not think that neurosis, the most usual reason, had brought him to me, but rather an inner urge to work on his psyche. A strong mother tie, however, and a fear of committing himself to life were hidden behind this urge, but these were only discovered during the analytical work with me. He had just completed his studies and taken a position in a large factory, and he was facing the many problems of a young man on the threshold of manhood. "It appears to me," he wrote in a letter asking for an interview, "that this phase of my life is particularly important and meaningful. I must decide either to remain unconscious in a well-protected security, or else to venture on a yet unknown way of which I have great hopes." The choice thus confronting him was whether to remain a lonely, vacillating, and unrealistic youth, or to become a self-sufficient and responsible adult. Henry told me